Thank you very much. Our next program is on the Cuban baseball defectors, an insider's full revelation. Our speaker is Mr. Peter Bartman, and I think you will all be immensely entertained and instructed by his program, his presentation. Thank you, Mr. Bartman.
I have a couple of introductory remarks, and I'll make them while you still can't hear anything until things finally settle down. First of all, do you want this in English or Spanish? There is a full written text of this presentation that I decided not to read, partly because I always find sitting through presentations when somebody's just looking at the laptop, reading the whole text is never as entertaining. And also, it proved to be a little bit too long, probably, to fit into the 20 minutes. But those of you who want the more amplified written text, the literary version presented for discerning readers like Jan Finkel, on the Baseball de Cuba website, I will post the full text of this along with these slides sometime in the next, let's say, 48 hours. And you can find it there. So I'm going to just talk you through this in a more informal way, and hopefully then leave some time for questions, because I'm sure there'll definitely be some questions. There's probably no hotter story in baseball this year than the Cuba phenomenon. This has been building the last couple of years, but certainly it seems to have kind of come to a peak last summer and this summer. First of all, with the sensational rookie month of Yasiel Puig last year, where he came within four base hits of matching Joe DiMaggio's 1936 record for rookie hits in the first month of a career. And in order to top that, we had to have something like the Jose Abreu phenomena this year, and Abreu has certainly gone, almost really gone Puig two or three times better. This weekend, while we're standing here, you know, the headlines have been the last 2 days about perhaps the most sensational trade deadline maneuver ever was the trade yesterday of Lester and Cespedes, and there's another Cuban figure right in the headlines. And then Abreu yesterday now extends his rookie hitting streak to 20 straight games on the heels, those of you who haven't been following, of an 18-game streak, so he's now hitting 38 of his last 39 games. And he's now really has a legitimate shot at breaking McGuire's rookie home run record set in 1987 and the rookie hitting streak record maybe. I mean, that's 34 games, was also in 1987. And then even a shot at Ted Williams' rookie RBI record, which I think is 145. The irony, the interesting thing about numbers and the full circle of numbers is that both of those, the hitting streak record and the home run record were set in 1987, and Abreu was born in 1987. So there's some kind of poetic justice going on here. But at any rate, the Cubans have very much been in the news the last year or so. And it's particularly an interesting phenomenon because you have so few Cubans compared to the other Latin American players. I think opening day rosters this year, if I remember the exact numbers correctly, there were 85 Dominicans, 59 Venezuelans. The Puerto Ricans have kind of fallen off the map now. I think there were only 11. There were 16 Cubans on opening day rosters this year. Of that number, 13 of them actually were what we would call defectors, or players who played in the recently played in the Cuban League and decided to leave Cuba to seek their fortunes in Major League Baseball. There are a number of other, there are three or four other Cubans hanging around the majors right now who were born in Cuba. Jose Fernandez, rookie of the year last year with the Marlins, left Cuba when he was very young, never played baseball there. Alan Nieto, who's the backup catcher for the White Sox, same story, left Cuba when he was 4 years old. But there are right now 13, 14, a couple of guys have been up and down, Cubans in the major leagues right now who are in that category of defectors. And defectors is a particularly interesting term, and I'm going to come back to make some comments about that in a couple of minutes. I mentioned the Puig sensational start last year, Abreu start this year. You've got Chapman the other night again going out there and throwing 105 miles an hour, I think, in something like 14 of the 16 pitches that he threw in that one inning. And then you have Cespedes becoming the first player since Griffey Jr. in the late 90s to win the home run derby 2 years in a row for whatever stock you put in the home run derby. To me, that's not really baseball, but you know, it was another case of a Cuban making headlines. So we also had five Cuban players in the All-Star game this year, and that's the most since 1968 when there were six. So it's really been suddenly kind of an unleashing of Cuban talent on the major leagues, on the major league level. This, I mentioned Abreu's, you know, a rather amazing start, and I think he will carry the headlines for much of the rest of the season. But this phenomena is not about to wind down. People are always asking me, well, you know, how many more? There are 20 or 30 more Abreu's out there. What are we going to see next year and the year after? And these guys continue to defect. I think we're reaching a little bit of a peak right now. The island talent has diminished somewhat with as many young players leaving as have. It's interesting because one of the things that's affected baseball in Cuba is the fact that you have, you hear the headlines about the 10 or 12 players that are making a big splash in the major leagues, but there have been over 75 players who have left there in the last 3 years. Many of them you'll never hear of. Many of them do not even get professional contracts. Some of them do sign and play in the low minor leagues. Some of them get up to double or triple A and never get into the majors. But this has been a tremendous drain on the Cuban league itself, which now finds itself with a 16-team league playing 17 and 18-year-olds. A lot of pitchers in that league who aren't even, you know, high university level now. And so the top players, and this is what has impacted on the Cuban national team and its dip in performance in the last couple of years after that highlight in 2006 when they went all the way to the finals of the World Baseball Classic. You've got these top hitters down there like Gurriel and Cepeda and Abreu last year before he left, facing about a third of the time guys that are throwing 80-mile-an-hour lollipops, and then when they get into these international tournaments, they really have to make a severe adjustment. And this is one of the things that's motivating some of the players now to leave, is the fact that the league is diminished enough so that they're not really being challenged there anymore. And so there's not only the lure of the big money in Major League Baseball, but there's also what all athletes at top level face, and that is the desire to test themselves at the highest level and to achieve more and more. And then suddenly when the Cuban national team is not winning overseas as it used to do, they're not the same level of idols back home as they used to be, and the playing conditions are getting worse in the league. Well, this is just a further motivation for leaving. But this phenomenon is not quite over yet. You've got Cincinnati Reds just signed a pitcher, Raciel Iglesias, who was the closer on the 2013 WBC in Japan, who to me is one of the best arms to come out of Cuba ever, really, I think. And this guy is going to be right now he's still stuck in Haiti because there are visa problems to getting him into the States, but he has been assigned to the Louisville AAA roster, 26-year-old middle reliever, who I think is going to be pretty sensational. And then you've got this young kid, Rusney Castile, in Miami right now working out, not yet signed, who was the batting champion and MVP in the very last Baseball World Cup in 2011 in Panama before that was discontinued, and then got injured and had a real dip for a couple of years in his performance in Cuba and then left, but he's apparently healthy now, and I think you're going to hear this name next year. And then you've got guys like Arboleda, who's in at AAA now, with been up a couple of times already with the Dodgers, who's a sensational defensive shortstop. So you're going to hear more from these guys over the next couple of years. Probably nothing brought the Cuba phenomenon more to the attention of most mainstream fans this past year than the story that broke early in the season in May about the controversies surrounding Puig and Puig's departure from Cuba and his travails traveling through Mexico and reaching the U.S. There was a story in L.A. Magazine that broke in May. Some of you may be familiar with that. Follow-up story by me on the Daily Beast about the revelations that had come out about the Puig situation, where he was smuggled out of Cuba with the help of Zeta drug cartel people in Mexico. A number of players have gone that route to get out of Cuba. And he arrived in Mexico, and then suddenly the price that he was asked to pay, he and his family were asked to pay when he left Cuba, was suddenly quadrupled. Of course, there was a big price on his head because these people had control over him, and he was a virtual prisoner in Mexico when they got him there. Could see, you know, multi-million dollar contracts, and they wanted a big piece of this. What eventually ended up happening, it's kind of humorous, but really not so much when you look at the real story behind the story, was that another, let's say, crime-related group in Miami got into the picture on this and actually kidnapped him away from the original kidnappers. And then he eventually made his way to the States, and there is still supposedly a lot of stories and rumors circulating about a price on his head right now. The Zeta Group was stiffed, and this whole operation never got a penny. And there was a similar story surrounding Leonis Martin with Texas, who also left that route through Mexico. And there are some things now that are in the legal process in Miami that, therefore, he can't talk about it. Not that he would anyway, but apparently there's a lot of ugly business behind what happened to get Leonis out of Cuba also. So these things have kind of brought also the other kind of ugly side of the story to the forefront. And one of the issues that was raised with the Puig situation when it broke in May was that in some respects, Major League Baseball, I mean, if you want to look at it from a certain angle, you know, kind of looking the other way on these situations like that might be kind of guilty of, if, I wouldn't want to say condoning, but kind of turning a blind eye on what is clearly in the eyes of many people human trafficking, and whether this, you know, what implications this has for the future relationship between MLB and the Cuban players that leave Cuba illegally by Cuban law and so forth, it's going to be is a real open question. So there is that side to the story. But this story goes back, the current wave of Cuban defectors. Some of you may know that I think there's 100, the last player to come up, Despaigne with the pitcher with San Diego, Odris Mir de Spain, pronounced de Spain or de España in Cuba, various pronunciations. Not to be confused with the great home run hitter down there now, Alfredo de Spain, who's still in Cuba, who was Cespedes' teammate in Granma. He's still there. They're not related at all. They come from two ends of the island. That's a popular name in Cuba. Number that the appearance of the Spain in, with San Diego this year brought the number to 183 Cubans in the major leagues now, and about a little over 50 of those have come since the early 1990s. And of that 50, there are some, as I mentioned before, who have actually been raised in the U.S. and played baseball in the U.S. and didn't play in Cuba. But of that 50, about I think it's we're up to 39 now are refugees or defectors from the current Cuban league. But the whole business starts back in 1991 with Rene Arocha, who walked away from the Cuban national team in a friendly series in Millington, Tennessee with the U.S. College All-Stars. And that made a little bit of a splash at the time back in Cuba. He was really the first one to do this. There had been one other player who had played in the Cuban league who appeared in the major leagues, and that was back in the 1980s, and that was Barbaro Garbay, who had a very short career with Detroit and Texas. Garbay was an interesting case because he was banned for life from baseball in Cuba and put in prison for being involved in a game-fixing scandal. And then when we had the Mariel boat lift in 1980, he was one of the ones when Fidel opened the prison doors and sent a lot of his unwanted people and criminals and prisoners to the U.S. in that boat lift. Garbay was one of the people that arrived on U.S. shores. And there was always a little bit of a controversy about the fact that he was allowed to play in Major League Baseball, having been actually convicted in a court in Cuba of game-fixing scandal. And, you know, Major League Baseball is abhorrence to betting and gambling and game-fixing and so forth. But the view always there, I guess, was, well, this wasn't really, this, all this was really was a blow at the evil communist system in Cuba. So it was okay. And he ended up playing a couple of years in the major leagues. But then after that, Arocha was really the first one that started the modern defection and then in, phenomena. And then in 1996, on the eve of the Atlanta Olympics, we had the defection of another pitcher, Rolando Araujo, who jumped the team right before the Atlanta Olympics. And that led to the suspension of that Cuba-U.S. friendly series, which was just started up again 3 years ago in 2012 and is now going on again. But the story really didn't become front page until Chapman. Chapman's $30 million contract, and that's what got the attention of people about the, you know, the Cuban defectors, and it really got the attention of the Cuban players back and the Cuban fans back on the island, because now suddenly that kind of money, geez, you know, if Chapman is Chapman actually had pitched a couple of times on the national team, but didn't even pitch in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. The rumor up here was it was because he was suspended because he tried to defect. That was not the case at all. He had simply been dropped from the Olympic team for poor performance. And in the 2009 World Baseball Classic in San Diego, he pitched against the Japanese and had a very bad outing. So he was not the shining top star pitcher in Cuba. He was a guy who could throw 105 miles an hour, you know, and that's why he was attractive for a certain role within a Major League Baseball. But that got the attention of players back in Cuba. And well, if he can make this kind of money, this is, you know, maybe it is worth risking family, risking, you know, personal safety to get out of here and maybe get to the U.S. and make that kind of money. So then we've had in recent years the rather astounding phenomena of these guys, you know, Abreu with a $68 million contract, which is actually with a lot of incentives and so forth, is an $85 million six-year contract, and the $42 million that Puig demanded, and Cespedes' big contract, and Chapman started a few years ago with $30 million, and then a steal to Spain, getting only a $1 million signing bonus with San Francisco. Now, he's another interesting case. I see he lost again the other night, and he's now 2-3 on the season. Won his first two games, had an ERA below one, and came within a couple of batters of pitching the first no-hitter 2 weeks ago in Padres history. And he would have been the first Cuban-born player ever to throw a no-hitter in the major leagues. He was a decent pitcher and a marginal member of the national team, but again, not a top pitcher in Cuba at the time that he left a couple of years ago at a tournament in Rotterdam, same place where Chapman had left a couple of years earlier. But he has a kind of funky motion, and he's a good control pitcher, and stepped right into the major leagues, a $1 million bonus, and within, you know, a month and a half, he's almost throwing the first no-hitter in Padres history. So that's kind of a background on the phenomenon that has gone on in recent years. Now, a big story broke last September. I was in Havana with ESPN, with Paul Levine of ESPN, filming some interviews with Tony Castro, the son of Fidel, who is the vice president of the sports ministry in Cuba. He used to be the national team doctor. He's an orthopedic surgeon. About the possible changes in Cuba and freeing up a little bit and letting some of their players leave and trying to reach some kind of detente with professional baseball. And we had just talked that weekend with Tony Castro about this subject, with Victor Mesa, the manager of the Cuban national team, and with one of the star players down there, Ulieski Gurriel. We get back to Miami on Saturday, and suddenly there's the story all over NPR about the fact that Cuba has announced a change in policy and they're going to release players to play in professional baseball. Some of you may remember that story last September. Badly mangled by NPR, badly mangled by both of the U.S., most of the U.S. media, who didn't really look closely at the details of what the Cuban announcement was. There were two parts to that Cuban announcement. So I had to immediately start writing all kinds of stuff on the website and so forth, trying to straighten this out and clarify it. What the Cubans have done in their change of policy is that they first of all announced that they would try to up salaries of their players in Cuba to try to cut down a little bit on the flow of players wanting to leave. And so up until this time, since 1962, Cuba had a so-called amateur baseball league, but the players were actually paid. They were compensated. They played baseball full-time. They were professionals. But they weren't paid as baseball players. They were paid basically as licensed athletes, as licensed coaches and sports players, and they all received the same salary, which amounted to, in the U.S. equivalent, about $40 a month. Now what they were going to do with this new policy was to up that slightly. The payment is in Cuban pesos. They were going to go up to a payment of 1,000 Cuban pesos a month. Just divide by 25 because it's 25 Cuban pesos. This is not the tourist money. Those of you who've traveled in Cuba, you know that there's two currencies. There's a convertible Cuban peso, which is equal to the euro, actually, worth more than the dollar, that all foreigners and tourists have to use, but we're talking the Cuban pesos that the Cuban people are paid in. And so they're gonna pay the players, as baseball players, $1,000 a month, and then a whole bunch of incentives for players who are on the national team. So players like Gurriel could earn, and Cepeda and some of these others could earn up to another possibly $800, $900 a year is about what it amounted to. Which was basically, by Cuban standards and in the Cuban economy, not that bad, but of course it's laughable compared to what these players could make outside of Cuba. So that was part of the change. They were going to start paying their players a little bit more. But the big news was that they were going to let some of their top players play in professional leagues outside of Cuba. Now, the conditions on this were that, first of all, the players were not free to negotiate. They couldn't just get in touch with other leagues and try to get a contract. This would be arranged by INDER, which is the National Sports Ministry, for the players, and INDER would negotiate with these other leagues. They would get contracts for certain players that they selected as a reward for some of their veteran players who had really performed well and who were still at the peak of their career, and they were hoping they wouldn't leave, send them out, let them play, make some money. And under the standard Cuban arrangement, 80% of their salary would go back to the government, and they would keep 20%. Now, by those of us who grow up in a free enterprise system, and we say, well, you know, that's ridiculous. Looking at it from the Cuban standpoint, however, this is a league. They're trying to keep their league in operation. They have no ticket sales revenue. They have no TV advertising revenue. They try to travel to international tournaments because the whole prestige of the nation really is hung more on baseball than anything else. This is where they've had their only international triumphs in the last 25 years. And to fund that operation, very difficult. They go to tournaments in Europe like the Harlem Baseball Week only because the Dutch Baseball Federation is willing to foot the bill and bring them there. Okay, they don't have the money to do it themselves. So this money, this 80%, you know, was not going into Fidel's Swiss bank accounts. It was going back to try to fund the league, to improve equipment. The fields are in bad shape down there. But the players would get only a small part of it, of course. The other big condition, however, was that the 20% for the player and the 80% for the sports ministry, had to go back to Cuba. And also that the players had to come back and play with their regular teams during the Cuban League season and be ready for national team duty at any time they wanted to use them for national team duty. This immediately meant there was no possibility of players coming to Major League Baseball for two reasons. First of all, OFAC does not allow the money to go back to Cuba. By the way, the Cuban team in the World Baseball Classic did receive payment for the first Classic in 2006. They have yet to be paid. Either the government, the part that went, you know, all of the federations got paid of all the different countries, and the players got paid. Well, the Cubans have never received anything because the money was released by MLB, but it's still being held by OFAC as part of the Helms-Burton embargo. So that's another economic blow their league has taken in recent years. But OFAC would not allow money to go back to Cuba. And, of course, Major League Baseball is not going to allow. They're not going to a star player like Abreu is not going to come here, and then they're going to let him go back in the winter and play a 90-game season. Okay, his agents won't allow that. Major League Baseball structure doesn't allow that. So there was no possibility of Major League Baseball. What the Cubans attempted to do, however, for some of these players is they started a procedure last summer with Mexico. And so they sent three players to Campeche in the Mexican League, including the star slugger Alfredo Spain, who immediately was a sensation down there. He played for the last half of the season, broke several records, including Martin Digo's 6-for-6 in a single game batting record, which had stood since 1930. And this worked well for the Cubans because, you know, the situation with, once Despain was under contract to the Mexican League, even if he wanted to walk away, he couldn't sign with Major League Baseball because of the agreement that MLB has with the Mexican League like they have with Japan. They can't sign players without open bidding to the league and a hefty bonus payment to the league itself. So that worked for last year. Well, this summer when Despain went back, MLB found a loophole in all of this to kind of try to block this. And so they organized baseball, reminded the Mexican League that as part of organized baseball, they had to abide by the policy, which now currently is because of the OFAC regulations. A Cuban player to sign with any organized baseball-related league has to have third country residence. So he has to basically renounce his Cuban citizenship and get a passport in another country. When this was pointed out to the Mexican League, the Campeche team immediately, some of you may remember this about a month ago in the press, they immediately arranged to have a Dominican passport made for Despain. And Enrique Rojas, a Dominican writer on ESPN.com, broke this story about the fake passport that Despain had. And picture of it there. And he was the league immediately had to backtrack, and he was banned from life from the Mexican League. So suddenly the Mexican connection was over. But they've now found another route, and that is with Japan. So three of the top players, Spain included, now is over in Japan with Lotte. Cepeda with the Yomiuri Giants, and Gurriel is playing with the now Bay Stars. And Cepeda was signed for a $900,000 contract with Yomiuri, of which he's going to pocket about $200,000 himself. Now, again, that's laughable compared to what that guy could have made. He was probably, before Abreu, next to Abreu, the best hitter in Cuba the last 15 years. Switch hitter. He was the only unanimous All-Star in the second World Baseball Classic in 2009 on the All-Star team. He was the only unanimous selection. But that $200,000 in Cuba, I mean, the $200,000 he's taken back, he's a very, very wealthy man in Cuba. So there's two sides to this story. You know, why does the Cuban government, and I don't think there's any possibility of detente here for a long time, as long because even though things are changing in Cuba, Fidel is gone, Raul's government is moving in another direction toward a modified form of capitalism, hopefully, but they're not about to open the doors and let their players go for two reasons that you have to realize. First of all, the Cuban League is a huge social institution within Cuba. It's really about the only entertainment people have. Baseball games used to be free up until the late 1990s. Now they cost 3 pesos, you know, 75 cents to go to a ball game. And a lot of the outlying provinces and those cities that have the capital cities that have teams, it's literally after 8 o'clock at night when the team is at home. It's the only thing you can do there. There's no lights anyplace else in the city. I mean, baseball is huge. Plus, it's the training ground for their national team to win these victories overseas. They're trying to sustain that league. They realize that the minute the doors are open and the players flood out of there, Cuba will have the same level of domestic national baseball that they now have in Puerto Rico and in Dominican Republic and Venezuela, which is zero, okay, because all the players will be of any quality will be playing outside the country. I have this debate with my Cuban friends all the time. They say, oh, we want to see Gurriel and these guys in the major leagues, and they'll come back and they'll play in the winter. No, they won't. You know, you're mistaken about that. You're not going to see them. It'd be great. You could watch them on television, but most Cubans don't have televisions that get anything but the three channels in Cuba. So, you know, you're gonna lose this institution. There's a very interesting parallel here that I want to draw for you to kind of bring this thing to a kind of a conclusion here. And that is, you look at the history of the Negro Leagues. Okay? Now, no one wants to set the clock back. No one wants to see segregated baseball. Don't misinterpret that I'm making any argument that Jackie Robinson shouldn't have been brought to the major leagues, that baseball, the major leagues should not have integrated. But there's always two sides to a coin. When that happened, in those cities, like Kansas City and Chicago and Pittsburgh, where there were large black neighborhoods that had an institution there, the business community was built around it, the social life was built around it, okay? And there was employment for hundreds of ball players. When Jackie Robinson and another small trickle of players started to go to the major leagues, suddenly there were 500 or 600 professional baseball players, black professional baseball players, who had no more careers because they couldn't play at that level and there were no more leagues for them to play at the level where they've been playing. Businesses collapsed. Many of those communities collapsed. We always talk about how, you know, the heart was taken out of Brooklyn when the Dodgers moved to L.A. Well, look at how the heart was taken out of the black neighborhoods in Kansas City when the Negro Leagues folded, okay? A similar thing is what Cuba is facing. They've got arguably the second, maybe if you think Japanese League is a little bit better, the third best league outside of Major League Baseball. It's unique because only Cubans play in the Cuban League. So it's a real alternative universe of baseball, and they're trying to keep that alive, and the only way they're going to keep it alive is kind of keep the doors closed and keep the lid on it. It's not going to happen. You know, eventually, I mean, that system cannot sustain itself, the political system there, the economic system. It's a third world country that's really been sliding the last 3 years, in particular, the economy has really gone sour. It's not going to last forever, but it's not going to be over as quickly as people think either, okay? So it's a slow process. I think there are some things, you know, what are the solutions? I don't think there are any immediate quick solutions to this thing, but I think there are a couple of things that can happen, and that is that Major League Baseball, for starters, for example, Major League Baseball and OFAC could change their policy and let the Cuban players who get out of Cuba, forget about, you know, the legality or illegality of how they're getting out of there, but if they get out of Cuba, they can come directly to U.S. shores. They can get a U.S. passport, okay, and they can sign with major league teams. However, under that situation, they would have to go into the free agent draft, the same as U.S. college players, with a maximum signing bonus of $250,000. This is much fairer to the U.S. college players who can't just go out and negotiate, you know, college player of the year this year, can't go out and negotiate with whatever major league team he wants for an $80 million contract. He's got to go through the draft procedure. Now, of course, the top Cuban players aren't going to want this, and this is why they themselves prefer to seek a third country residence because their agents prefer this because of the top dollar contracts they could get. But if that situation was changed that way, it would cut off the situations like the Puig exit through Mexico, because the involvement of crime elements to smuggle these players out when they have $80 million possible contracts, you know, on their heads, this is going to evaporate if now they're suddenly worth on the open market $250,000 signing bonus instead of, you know, $80 million, or what will the next one get, $90 million. So, but it's a complex issue. It's not going to change right away. There are, as I've tried to point out, some really ugly sides to the story, but also some really great success stories for some of these players. There's a full written text, as I mentioned, and you can find that on the Baseball de Cuba website in the next 48 hours or so. So, questions? Yes. Well, Latin baseball in general, you know, Latin players have always played. I mean, you can go back to the 1950s with Vic Power, right, when he came up with the Kansas City Athletics, you know, the flashiest first baseman. The Yankees didn't want him because he was a black player, but also because he was in the Yankee minor league system, his flashy style of play. This has always been characteristic of Latin baseball, but it kind of varies with player to player, too. Puig has drawn attention to this, okay? You look at Puig and you say, oh, look, the stereotype, the typical Latin American, you know, flashy player, and he doesn't hit cutoff men and he runs into walls. Look at Abreu. Abreu is the total opposite. You talk about a workman-like, quiet, business-like player who just hits the hell out of the baseball. Okay? This is Abreu. Cepeda is an Abreu-type player. So is Gurriel. You've got both extremes in Cuba. So, yeah, this gets a lot of attention. The media loves it and so forth, but I think that this is more not so especially Cuba. It's Latin America and it's individual players. Yes?
I was very interested in the whole presentation, but particularly in those five...
Stand up, please.
Yeah, use mic.
Okay. Particularly in those final comments about how if they went into the draft, the cartels would lose interest in them. Because I can't help but be a little concerned about potential threats to the integrity of baseball if you have players arriving in the major leagues with a substantial obligation to organized crime cartels for having them gotten there. Would you want to comment on that?
I spend a lot of time following the Cuban national team overseas. As some of you know, I've spent a lot of time in Cuba, but I spent a lot of time with the team overseas. One thing I didn't get to talk about, and it's in the written presentation, is just a sidetrack for just a second, is this whole issue of security around the Cuban players. This is one of the biggest myths, that they're under armed guard, you know, and there's tight security around the players, but there's tight security around the players in order to keep away the agents, in order to keep away the girls, you know, who want to, I mean, these guys are like rock stars overseas, in order to keep away the distractions because they're so focused on winning baseball, okay? So there's misconceptions about that. But I'm around the team overseas, and I talk with a lot of international scouts who are friends of mine, and one of the things we talk about all the time is, you know, it's really pretty amazing that we haven't had a Leonis Martin or a Yasiel Puig or one of these guys who was already an established star in Cuba simply disappear or be found at the bottom of a lake someplace, okay? It may be a matter of time until if this continues with the Mexico thing. Now, they're not all going through Mexico. What's happening, I should explain one thing. It's the thing that everyone wants to know is how are the players getting out of Cuba? And, of course, the players won't talk about that. And they won't talk about it and even to people who are close to them like I am. And I don't ask them. I don't push it. They don't talk about it because protecting family that is still back on the island, because of protecting other former teammates back there who may want to go similar routes, and protecting people who may have helped them get off the island down there, who would face prison terms in Cuba. Because the economy is so bad, because everybody's on the take now in Cuba, as in many third world countries, There's been a lot of, it's been a lot easier to simply bribe Coast Guard officials in Cienfuegos or up in Matanzas on the northern coast to look the other way when boats are leaving. A number of these players have been taken into Haiti and the Dominican Republic. That's the route that Abreu went. That's the route that Iglesias just went. That's the route Arboena just went. And those guys have had, at least they haven't had, they haven't been involved with the Mexican cartel people, which is a really a bad element. But yeah, it's a matter of time, I think, if this continues until we have some really ugly situations where somebody's going to get killed, either families of players or the players themselves.
Can you tell us a little bit about the citizenship status of these players? I know just because they defect doesn't mean they're citizens here, I don't think.
No.
And especially since they've come through all these other countries, are they men without a country?
Most of them are third country residents in name only because they have a passport from Costa Rica or the Dominican Republic, in most cases Dominican Republic. Alexei Ramirez, who's now been with the White Sox since 2008, is just about to take his citizenship exam. He's going to become a U.S. citizen. El Duque Hernandez just recently became a U.S. citizen. So some of these players, after a while, eventually have, just like Ozzie Guillen from Venezuela, eventually became a U.S. citizen. But most of them have a technical residence, documented residence in other countries, but live in the States. So Ollie Abreu has a house in Chicago already and a house in Miami. I know Cespedes lives in Pompano Beach, Florida, and so forth. Contreras lived for years, still has a ranch in Tampa. And so, but I don't think Contreras is a U.S. citizen yet. He's now back playing in Mexico, by the way, trying to make his way back to the majors. He's playing in the Mexican League this summer.
One more question, and then we'll have to wrap things up.
Could you ever envision a Major League franchise in Havana?
Yeah, probably maybe the end of the 21st century, maybe 2095 or something. Look, you can't put a Major League franchise in Mexico City. You can't put a Major League franchise in Memphis, Tennessee, okay? The necessity of corporate sponsorship, television market, okay, rules out even small. I mean, you're having trouble keeping a major league team in Kansas City, and now they're talking about going maybe back to Montreal with Kansas City or somebody, okay? No, I mean, this is a third world country where people pay in Havana 75 cents to go to the ball game, okay? And the infrastructure is so bad, and the necessity of rebuilding the infrastructure just to get electricity to work and the water system to work in a 3.5 million population city like Havana, which has been basically ignored without any infrastructure improvement since 1959, an economic situation viable in a city like Havana, which would support even minor league baseball, which is an expensive proposition in the United States at this day and age, is just out of the question for, I don't know, I would project 100 years, 75 years or whatever, but that's what you're looking at. You know, you're going to be 25 years. If things change tomorrow, you'd be 25 years rebuilding Havana.
Thank you. Mr. Barber, outstanding presentation. Thank you very much.